Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Finding Your Secret Sauce for Strategy, Governance, and Portfolio Management. A couple housekeeping notes before we get started. Please remember to take some time to fill out the online evaluations after the session. You can actually get those at the email kiosks and also online at the EDUCAUSE site. We're going to be doing a little bit of a lightning round sort of approach today with our speakers. We have four speakers here for your pleasure today. We have Tracy Schroeder from Boston University, who's the Vice President of Information Services and Technology. We have Fred Damiano, the CIO of Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. And we have Susan Mollish, the Vice President and CIO of Loyola University in Chicago. And we have Peter Greco, the CIO of Regis University in Denver. Great. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to our speakers, and thank you very much.
Thanks, John. Good afternoon, everybody. Let me just give you a quick orientation to how we've structured our discussion. We're going to try to keep each school's presentation to about 7 minutes or so. So we'll be giving you a 10,000-foot flyover view, really. There's obviously a lot more depth that we could go into on some of these topics. We'll round robin the panel, and each one of us will cover the following four things. We'll give you a quick institutional profile because we have some diverse schools in terms of makeup, culture, size, that sort of thing. We'll talk about the governance structure that we currently have in place, and then we'll highlight some of the secret sauce ingredients that we feel we've been using and highlight what's working well and what are some of the opportunities we believe where we could improve. We'll wrap things up with a few common themes that we learned as we actually went through putting some of this stuff together. We have a few questions to consider, and then we'd like to invite some questions, comments, and additional observations after that. So with that, I will turn it over to Tracy Schroeder at Boston University.
Good afternoon. So about a little bit about BU. We're a major private residential research university. Very entrepreneurial in spirit, and as far as an institution to be governed from a technology perspective, something of a wild beast. Large and diverse of opinion, diverse of needs. This is the governance structure. This was just recently put in place. We spent the summer and fall and early spring really discussing, orienting people to the idea of what IT governance is, and what its objectives are, and what the overall structure might be, and then getting representatives nominated into groups, and those groups began meeting in the late spring, about the March-April timeframe. So what was in place before was really sort of a loose collection of the things that have generally categorized at the bottom here, the coordination groups, project steering committees, and user groups. There were also a set of what we called domain IT portfolios that were from a fairly early life cycle project portfolio management effort that was rooted in local client areas from the applications perspective. But there really wasn't a place, if you had an item in one of these portfolios that really had enterprise implications, to take it for broader discussion. What we created was really this piece here, the service area committees, which were based principally upon a service catalog structure that we created not only for our client-facing website, but then in a consolidated form for governance purposes in order to engage folks around the major areas of service that we provide. These are principally client-populated committees, so they are co-chaired by two generally executive-level client representatives. There is a leadership-level IT, central IT support person for the committee, and then the membership of the committee is a combination of faculty, staff, and students, with the center of gravity being more faculty or more staff, depending upon the nature of the service. So, for example, the research computing committee is almost entirely faculty with a handful of staff and a couple of students, whereas the administrative systems and reporting committee is more heavily staff with a few faculty and students. The executive steering committee, we try to tie, create some continuity here in that the co-chairs of the service area committees are the members of the executive steering committee, which is chaired by the executive vice president and the provost of the medical campus, the provost of the Charles River campus, and myself. So what's the thinking behind this, the secret sauce, if you will? The first was really defining service areas, getting people at BU to begin to think about IT, particularly central IT, in terms of what services we are providing as opposed to a collection of components or a collection of groups of people coming from a variety of different places. It was very much a unifying and clarifying thing to try to define these are our core areas of service that we're providing to you. Valuable, also challenging. Thresholds for project review. What has to go to this? A lot of discussions about, well, you're going to try to govern everything that moves. How big does the project have to be? What were the major factors for what has to go to governance? The major factors or the areas were, of course, cost, impact, and risk. The cost threshold that we used was over $100,000 in external cost, impact, enterprise impact, and risk. Was it a critical or high? Engagement is really important for us in that we had a sense that people did not feel that IT decisions were grounded in the needs of the community, or they didn't understand how IT decisions were made. They didn't feel part of them. So a big part of sort of the breadth and depth of the committee structure that we created was that we were trying to engage significant numbers of people and the right people. And the third piece is action, is that people had to feel that and know that their participation in these groups was actually going to result in something. They weren't going to show up, talk, and then IT would do whatever the heck it wanted to anyway. We've been very deliberate this fall in going through our budget formulation process with these committees, going through, this is the current list of projects, this is the proposed potential list of projects, which ones do you think we should refine further for our budget submission, what things are not on the list at all that should be, which things should be set aside. And folks are seeing that their input is actually resulting in what we're going to propose. So what's working well? We do have some increased awareness and understanding. We get comments from folks participating in the meetings that they didn't know we were working on all of these things. They didn't know we even provided some of these services. It's also building some awareness among the IT staff about what kinds of questions and information the community wants about our services, especially as they present more of the infrastructure level proposals to the clients, getting questions from them about relative priority, order of operations, is sometimes enlightening for the staff to think about things from a client perspective. Areas to improve. Sometimes difficult to categorize what service area something belongs in, and sometimes things, particularly policy, say information security policy, it can start in the information security area, but it's actually going to have to be vetted by pretty much every service area committee before it can become policy. Measuring resource utilization. And projecting accurately, we set our threshold based upon external cost, but everybody knows that internal cost is a very important measure too, and deciding which internal cost things should go to governance and how accurate are our projections on what those internal costs are is a significant challenge. Relationships to locally funded initiatives. So if the client has money, do they have to go through the process? And the answer there is yes, if it meets the enterprise impact and risk criteria. So that's sometimes something that is bad news for the client. But there's also the inverse that if they don't have money, but it has an enterprise implication that is positive, or mitigates a significant risk to the university, it also can go to governance and might actually get funded. Another challenge is just timely and thorough preparation for these meetings. When you've got meetings happening every 6 to 8 weeks for each of six service area committees, it really drives your agenda and activity within the IT organization and takes some keeping pace with. And so that's BU at a high level. I think I did it in 7 minutes, didn't I?
Right.
And next we have Fred Damiano from Hobart and William Smith.
Thank you, Tracy. Good afternoon, everyone. As far as an institutional profile for us, we're a small liberal arts school just outside of Rochester, New York, and Geneva, New York. And from a panel perspective, I would represent the smallest school in terms of size. What I would say to you is that prior to joining as CIO in 2004, I spent 21 years in industry working at Xerox and McDonnell Douglas Space Systems Company. And what I often tell people is that we may be small, but we're not uncomplex. We may not have the scale or, in essence, the number of transactions or things that have to get done, but the variety and breadth really isn't very different in terms of bigger schools or bigger institutions. But that's a quick profile of who we are in terms of size of students, staff, and where we are located, neatly on the shores of Lake Seneca. Okay, before I actually joined as CIO, there was no formal governance structure in place at the institution. There was nothing in place that actually would set priorities on an annual basis or anything that would intercept the institution's funding process or budgeting process. What I've opted to do in terms of trying to do this in 7 minutes is to do the flyover. Susan talked about it being at 10,000 feet. This is probably more at about 25,000 feet, but I've opted to do it more of in a workflow type approach to give you a sense of how some of these things come together, understanding the assumptions. There's a lot of detail underneath this. The first place we start, and much like Tracy talked about with committee structures and different places and sources for requests, what we did and what we've done is where we could formalize through committee structure, we have formalized how requests or needs are handled. In other words, we've given those formal channels. So we've got a faculty IT committee, there's an administrative IT committee, but needs can come from other sources. There are student councils and groups that are in place. We've got a trustee technology subcommittee. Our vendors, you know, the products that we buy could be being upgraded that we've got to do things with. So what we try to do is identify what all these different channels are. And we get those channels to document, you know, what is in fact the need and what is the justification for actually having to move forward with a particular project. And much like Tracy talked about, knowing what has money and what doesn't out of the gate, we know that right from the very inception in terms of where the source of the request is coming from and what the status of it is. Once we've got these requests, one of the key things we then do at that point is we tag them. Okay, and there are basically four tags that can be put on a request. You can be identified as having a remedial need, which means something is broken and it's got to be addressed immediately. It can be a refresh and renewal, computers needing to be replaced, things that you would think about with hard assets that you've got to deal with. You can have an operations need. These would be more soft costs in terms of licenses that you have to pay for, ISP connection, anything around those types of costs. And then we've got strategic. Strategics basically says, we have something here that is new that is going to expand the technology footprint that will require some sustaining funding as you go forward. So once we have the needs, we now tag these things. Then what we do is then it goes to an executive committee. And that executive committee at this point in time is where we intercept the institutional budgeting process. And this is a group that is not only looking at these different requests, but they now have to consider these in a broader context. There could be educational goals. There could be operational imperatives. There could be environmental variables in play, much like what was going on in the financial sector and is still playing out right now. They have to take all that and then create, in essence, one budget profile for the institution. So it's at this moment in time that the IT need is now bundled in with the general institutional budget process, and it's at a line item level, so it has its own line item detail. That is then taken to the Board of Trustees, and that trustee group is then tasked with looking at this full demand case and determining what, in fact, is going to be the level of funding. What I can tell you is that the demand case always outstrips the supply for the resources, be they time, money, or people. But it's at this moment in time where that, in essence, that line gets drawn in terms of what is, in fact, going to happen. Once that review is done and the trustees determine what kind of funding profile you're going to have for the coming year, the pieces all come together at that moment in time. And then what we do is we communicate. And then there's a split off at this point. here's where we close the loop back. So basically all the originators now know here's in fact what has occurred with the need request. And at the same time, those things that are above the line now become part of the project portfolio that gets tracked. So we have tried to create basically a governance process that is a full workflow, it's closed loop, and so that all the folks in the process know precisely what is happening and when. For the portfolio that's in place, we're managing the three parameters, time, scope, and cost, and you can be red, yellow, or green. And much like Kermit the Frog says in the Muppet movie, it ain't easy being green all the time, okay? Because if you're green, everyone thinks you're great, but that isn't necessarily the case. But here's what we do. It's a green, yellow, red stoplight kind of thing to help tell us if you've got a project in trouble and, in fact, what that project needs to do if, in fact, it is in trouble. When you come to the secret sauce part, we all kind of took our different approaches to this thing. My wife is a big fan of Jada, so I pull out a Jada recipe and I try to follow it. But basically, if you look at it, you know, it starts with leadership and sponsorship from the top. Who's originating and driving this? You've got to have project management discipline in there right from the beginning. And when you've got all that, you've got to bring that to a full simmer. You've really got to get that cooking. Because once you have that, you've only really begun. Then you're into the relationship building kind of things, the team building kinds of things. You've got to be communicating. And then you garnish that with measurement and accountability. You know, how are we doing in terms of what we decided we were going to do? When you look at what's working well and opportunities for improvement, I think that we've done a good job of creating transparency, visibility. We've integrated with the institutional process, which is a big thing. Don't fight it. Just figure out how to leverage it. And we've simplified the monitoring and control. From an opportunity for improvement perspective, you know, we could do better in terms of estimating and the initial upfront parts of this. More consistency in terms of reuse of artifacts as we build a portfolio of work that gets done and actually building a repository that actually houses this so we can get better as we go forward. So that's kind of the 30,000 flyover from a Hobart and William Smith perspective. And we're still tracking on time. I'm going to turn it over now to Susan Mollish from Loyola University in Chicago.
Thanks, Fred. Quick view of Loyola. We're located in, we have two campuses in the city of Chicago, one in the suburbs and one in Rome. We have a couple of satellite locations outside of Chicago that we're developing programming for, and then two international affiliates that we don't own but operate. 12 schools and colleges, a fair amount of research activity, and then just to note on the bottom, in terms of IT services, I think this can be an important element in how you approach some of these things. I would estimate about 75% centralized, a little over 90 staff, and obviously a lot of augmented by a lot of student workers, depending on the time of year. So to give you a view of our current governance structure, if you start at the top there, we have an executive steering committee that I chair that is comprised of the provost and five or six other VPs. So a subset of the cabinet really comprises that group. And they are supported by these five subcommittees that are focused more, as opposed to more broadly, more in depth on focused technology topics. So we have the Academic Technology Committee focusing on technologies related to teaching, learning, research. We have the Data Governance Committee, which is actually the newest subcommittee established within the last year to support our data warehousing effort. So they are led by institutional research, and they're establishing the consistent data definitions across the institution. The third one, the Project Review Board, actually does a lot of the legwork for the steering committee in terms of our project prioritization process. So they accept all the new project requests, they pre-review them, they pre-rank them, pre-prioritize them, and then the executive steering committee takes those high-level major initiatives and gives them a final review. The fourth one, the Architecture Review Board, really builds the technology roadmap and does strategic planning for technology, manages change throughout our technology portfolio. I'll show you an example of that. And then finally, the last one, the Security Council, which obviously handles a lot of the security projects, issues, policies for the institution. So to try to capture our secret sauce ingredients, we'd combine equal parts of the following things. Governance, simple illustrations, which I'll explain, relationship management, technology roadmap, and then backing that up with metrics. And what I'm going to do is just cycle through this quickly and show you illustrations of what these things look like for us. So the first one, you saw the governance structure. This is an output of the process that we use. So we prioritize projects every 6 months, and this is the result of the exercise. So we have each member of the committee prioritizing our major initiatives. We have a reverse point ranking system that comes up with our portfolio. We have a conversation, discussion about it, so if anything looks a little bit out of whack, we can adjust things from there, but this process has been working very well for us for about the last 4 years. Simplify through illustration. So one of the things that we found is that it is true, a picture is sometimes worth 1,000 words. So rather, when we're trying to explain what our project portfolio looks like, rather than giving them a big list of projects with a lot of verbiage behind that, we'll take that mapping of those major initiatives that you just saw prioritized and map them across what we call, this is called the ITS Rings of Excellence. So we have five major categories of projects, and they usually fall into one of these buckets. And so very quickly, if you're a faculty member or an administrative leader or a student and you really want to focus on the area, you know, it's the what have you done for me lately kind of view. You're going to gravitate toward the ring first that really matters to you. In terms of relationship management, we use a similar approach to what Fred talked about in terms of stoplighting the relative health of things. So we not only have red, yellow, green, we have orange and lime. But the color coding is very effective with our project sponsors and with everyone else, even within IT. None of the people on the IT staff ever want their project to be anything less than green. So it really does draw attention to where we need help, where we're running into roadblocks, and how we go about resolving them. We have weekly status, monthly status, quarterly status. Depending on the complexity of the project, we don't do that for every single project, but we try to apply it and work with the sponsor to come up with a schedule that makes sense. The fourth one was the roadmap, and this is really where architecture comes in. So this has been a very helpful tool for us in terms of talking about strategic planning both internally and externally. So that bottom base is really where our core investments are. If we're going to be making a new technology selection, we really need to make sure that it works well with those things that are in our core. And then the columns up above represent where we have technology change underway in the organization. And there are a number of different kinds of change that you can see here that we're managing. And then finally, the last one is, this is one metric view that we use. We have an annual scorecard that we use to communicate the relative health of larger categories of technology. We've been doing this for the last 4 years. We're working on year 5 now. The arrows don't always go to the right, so sometimes we have a relatively healthy element, technology element, that turns unhealthy for a lot of different reasons. You can't sit still and expect everything to stay green. So this helps us foster some of those discussions that we need to have in terms of what's important to the institution. We may have something in here that's red. We acknowledge it is, but it's not something we want to invest in or that we can invest in right now. But at least we understand where we are. So in terms of what's working well, I think some of these things have given us a repeatable, consistent way of telling our story. So it helps communicate definitely in ways that people can understand that don't work in technology every day. Definitely increases transparency, shared understanding of our priorities, our investments, where we have to make trade-offs, what the implications of those trade-offs are. And it makes it more difficult for people to have that more siloed approach to only caring about what's in their purview, because we're having these broader-based discussions, and you've really got to be representative of what's in the institution's best interests. And then finally, where we'd like to improve, we'd like to do a better job of resource planning. That seems to be a more broadly-based challenge with some of my colleagues as well. We do a relatively good job resource planning with a gut feeling and experience and that sort of thing, but it becomes more difficult to manage when obviously resources are tight. Engaging faculty and students in this process on a regular basis. We have some limited success with that, but it's not been sustained and repeatable the way some other things have been, so they're kind of unwieldy groups to kind of keep engaged in an ongoing way. And then finally, planning technology with the budget cycle. You know, we all plan so far in advance. We don't know what we're going to be doing 18 months from now, and I'm trying to predict some of the costs of this stuff is a real challenge. And just the last note, we're never done. So we keep working on this. We adjust it. We borrow from other people. So it's been a very interesting process so far. So that's Loyola, and with that, I'll turn it over to Peter Greco from Regis.
Thank you, Susan. Regis University is a Jesuit university in Denver, 130 years old. We are a Carnegie Master's L class, 15,000 almost students, but we're deceptively large, or I should say maybe we seem smaller than that number might make us look. 5,000 of our students are online. Of those 15,000, 11,000 are working professionals, and they are classified really as part-time, not full-time. So our iPads number is really closer to 8,000, to give you a sense of what our size might appear to be. Just over 2,000 faculty. Vast majority of those are affiliates, so again, part-time in that range. We have a rather small main campus, so if you visited us, you'd also wonder where we're putting these 15,000 students. But we do have satellite campuses, 7 in the Front Range in Colorado, and 1 in Las Vegas. So a somewhat different model than my colleagues have here. The IT services profile is really 85% or so centralized, so 52 staff that I have. There are some other IT folks outside of the ITS department. So that's Regis. Our structure, probably wouldn't surprise you, is committee-based. I think that's what higher ed does. And we have two tiers. There's a traditional academic and administrative split. That's been covered. There's nothing really different about how Regis does that. You can see here under the bullets. We do policy review through these committees as well, although that is not nearly the expenditure of time that certainly proposal review would be. There's a third committee at the first tier, which is the infrastructure, the technology infrastructure committee, and that's a really technical committee, a group of IT staff largely, but looks at IT support and IT policy and, you know, more of the infrastructure things that require a lot of IT knowledge. That's tier one. Tier two is really the executive group, which approves portfolio selection and as well as policy review and approval, and also does strategic planning with respect to, we call it our digital plant, with respect to digital plant adoption and use profile and resources. Membership on these committees at the executive level includes the academic vice president and the 3 college deans. Administratively, the 2 administrative vice presidents are involved, and then I'm on the committee as well as CIO. We wanted to have continuity so that executive staff members or executive technology members are actually facilitators or chairs of the subcommittees. So on the academic side, the academic vice president and a rotating, I don't mean spinning around, I mean one of the 3 deans will, on a periodic basis, be a co-chair. And then it's really made up of faculty, people in our learning design units, which is distance learning and support, and then an IT manager. Administrative technology, again, the 2 administrative vice presidents, middle management, and an IT manager, again. Technology infrastructure is a little different there because we've got physical plant involved, but otherwise it's really IT. We have college faculty as well, usually a CIS, a person who does IT instruction involved there. Our secret sauce begins with the old Educom concept. I don't know if anybody in the room remembers the old Educom concept of early follower, which is to say that we try to do things in the second quartile in higher ed in terms of adoption and use. Now, it wouldn't be secret sauce if I told you how often we succeeded at that, so I'll just keep that secret. The project portfolio is fiscal-based, so what we try to do is fill buckets. It is largely driven with money, but, of course, resources. There's only so many resources that can be dedicated to project work in a given year. And that's really how we divide things up. So we may map a project out for a couple years based on what money or resources are available. We're about an 80-20 maintenance to development ratio at Regis, which means that we spend about 20% of our time dedicated to projects that come through this process, the governance process. A proposal would be required for that 20% of time if funds are needed, if more than 40 hours of development work are required, if a new function or service is going to be created, or if there has to be infrastructure modification. The 40 hours, by the way, is somewhat arbitrary, but it seems to be working out. We had to pick a number, right? It seems to be working out. What we do there is we start with consulting and tuning at the level where somebody's an initiator, works with the IT department, people on my staff, to come up with costs and hours and all kinds of good information to put into the proposal. And then it goes to the first level of review at that committee, in that committee structure that I showed you. That first level of review, there's always a primary committee. Sometimes it's shared between more than one committee if it sometimes bridges academic and infrastructure and whatnot. And that primary committee then scores the proposal in a strategic manner. Now, there's more secret to our sauce because I don't have it to show you today, so I'll just tell you how wonderful it is. It's just a great thing. So after that, it's scored. It goes through the executive approval process. Most often at that point, when it makes it to that stage, things are approved. It's really just sliding it into an appropriate fiscal year. So what's working well? Well, we've got our strategic foot in the door, and that's really important because really before this process, and this is about a two-year, almost three-year-old process, before this process, we were decidedly tactical. The digital plant, as we refer to it, was really used to avoid a competitive disadvantage. So I'm seeing that change, and it's really exciting, certainly in my role. The next thing that I think is important is that we've got a common sense of the landscape. I think Susan mentioned it, I think Tracy did at first, that people are saying, we didn't know you were doing that, or those kinds of things come up all the time, and it's really been a blessing. People have, there's less mystery around IT. We all know about that mystery around IT. We have transparency in the process. The initiative, as it begins, is proposed very publicly online. It's the whole review process is online with minutes. Once a project exists, it is managed online. So there's a lot of transparency all the way through. And we've leveled the playing field, the haves and the have-nots. And I thought that was a good comment about, you know, if I have money, do I have to go through the process? Well, yeah, you do. And there are times when you don't, I guess, if you really could get away from those four criteria that I listed. But the playing field has really been leveled. Certainly we can improve things. And on the other side of we're now more strategic, we are far too tactical, right? And that's something that I hope to see better in the coming years. Culture eats governance for lunch. I think that's self-explanatory. I stole that. I wish I could claim to have invented it myself, but I think it's something you all understand, and it's something that we're experiencing. I won't spend any time explaining it. I could give tons of examples, as I'm sure all you could as well. Estimation of effort against available resources is probably the biggest issue for us from a very technical or logistics standpoint. We really have trouble. We tend to estimate in a manner that gets us into a lot of work in a short amount of time. And that's, believe me, not intentional. We just can't. It's hard to justify sometimes even doing math and using metrics to say how much time is available and what we can really get done in a certain amount of time. We're not doing badly. We just aren't doing as well as we'd like. And last, we really want to try to create a project management office university-wide, but we need to have more of that mentality in our IT group, that we're not really doing project management in a you know, that sort of professional manner. We tend to assume that people know things when they don't always know them. So be that as it may, that's really Regis's part. What I want to do is provide you the first of the things that we want to give you today as a takeaway. And the common themes across all of our institutions as we discuss this, the first was purpose. And our concept of the secret sauce, really, if you use that concept and take it a little further to talk about a restaurant that might have a secret sauce. Many restaurants have secret sauces, right? So there's a common purpose there that you might draw, and that's really what we want to say. There's no real one way to do governance, certainly. I was impressed by what my colleagues presented today, and I got some ideas. So certainly, even the way I'm doing it is not a way that we'll probably be doing it in the future, right? So something important there. Next, there are certain common challenges, and I just alluded to it. I don't know that I need to repeat it, but we all have trouble with estimation of project effort and resource planning. It's anybody who's managed a project, and I can't imagine there's anybody in here who hasn't. It's a difficult thing to do, certainly. Last, common benefits. Obviously broaden communication and the leveling of the playing field, but all for a sense of buy-in. And that's really important in our business, right, is that you want those that you support, your constituents, to buy into the process, to include them, to make them feel supported, certainly. So, okay, and I believe Tracy's going to close out.
This is a set of questions that we realized going through what we had each prepared and thinking about the processes that we went through to develop our respective governance models. These are questions that we had asked ourselves that we wanted to suggest, basically, that you might want to ask yourself in trying to develop the right governance structure for your institution. We're a fairly diverse set of institutions. We don't have a public institution up here, but certainly in terms of size, complexity, mission, we're fairly diverse. But we each had to ask ourselves about the cultural factors, the timing factors that we need to take into consideration in identifying our governance model, and how to translate those factors into that model, into the mechanics, and how we could best drive evidence-based decision-making and bring people together in a way that would be not just a battle of wills or loudest voices, but using data to make decisions. So we suggest these to you as things you might want to think about. And with that, any questions or discussion for the panel?
One of the questions up there referred to timing. Can you give me an example? Are you talking about the institution of a governance structure in terms of when that was implemented, or is there another dimension of timing that refers to? Maybe one of you or several could give examples.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question yet.
It's your question about timing.
Yeah. I'll answer that. I think that had to do with thinking about where your institution is with regard to thinking about governance. If the institution has had some form of governance for 10 years, then they're going to be ready for a different type of committee structure and process. If you've had a PMO for 5 years, you're going to be ready to provide a different set of metrics than if you don't have a project manager on your campus. Those are sort of readiness factors. How long have certain things been in place? Have they never been in place at all? To think about when you might be ready for what scale of process, what level of complexity in your process, and what level of engagement in your process.
For Loyola, we do our planning, our big planning, in 6 months. 6 month chunks, so twice a year. Anything more than that is really difficult to keep the engagement level up. And in addition to our turnover in terms of our portfolio, that's what felt right for us, and that's been working well to this point.
What I would add at Hobart and William Smith, we've got clearly the annual piece that's fairly formalized. It also comprehends the notion that there can be something that can emerge in cycle. So how you deal with that from an exception basis. And generally what has to happen is you can process it. You still require the same level of detail and discipline around the justification for the need. And if, in fact, if there is not incremental money that can be applied to it, then a decision has to be made about what was on the list that now has to come off the list.
I can start because I certainly did deal with that in my presentation. We are trying to do what we can, and actually I was a little generous. I said 80-20, and I think we're probably closer to 85-15, really, only 15% maintenance. But And you referred, the end of your question was about metrics, and that's obviously we don't have the greatest metrics in the world because I made a guess, and as I'm measuring, I'm thinking that we're probably not right where I'd like us to be. In terms of what we can do to reduce maintenance, certainly we're doing what we can to try to increase funding for flexibility with respect to contracting work. There is, if you can get a hired gun to do certain kinds of things and if you can manage it well, that's a way to be flexible. So the answer never has to be no. The answer has to be, well, it's going to cost this much. And that's a far better way to sort of keep with your maintenance and development profile, if possible. That's really the only tactic that I have at this time, the only one that I'm employing, looking at others. But
some of what we've been trying to do is take some of the things that have been historically presented as maintenance activity that were actually significant projects and put them through this process. And I think that's really what you get when you're looking, well, where did we set our thresholds for review? Because it's not that we're trying to be obstructionist or get in the way of things getting done, but there are lots of projects masquerading out there as service requests. And trying to determine where to set that threshold so that we catch those things and apply some appropriate judgment is really some of the trick.
I would also add, at Hobart William Smith, to build on what Tracy just said about projects that masquerade as other things, we try to stay away from the word maintenance. You noticed I used the tag of refresh and renewal, right? That can apply to capital assets or hard goods. It can also apply to things like you've got to do something to upgrade your ERP. And if your Oracle DBA or your DBA is going to be doing that and they can't be made available to do something new, some trade-off has to happen at that point, which is to Peter's point of, where in fact do you in fact fund that from. Okay, but we try to stay away from not have these things masquerade as, not being important projects.
I'm interested to hear from each of you roughly how many work items or projects your executive committee is expected to have familiarity with at any point in time. Not details of where they are, but how big is the list?
I can start. That's a great question, by the way. Because you use the word expect. And I have an expectation that they would have good, reasonable knowledge of everything that's the titles that are in the portfolio and what they're about. When it gets to detailed knowledge, not enough that probably a third of what we do. And we roughly do 30 a year at this level for our 20% development resource. So roughly 10 are top of mind, I think. In each case, they aren't the same 10 amongst all members, right? Certainly, I have to remember all 30, and it's working. We're coming along, but I think that's a great question, something to consider. It's an educational process, right? We're growing and getting better. I think 2 to 3 years ago, I was happy if they had 5, so it's getting better.
I would say at Loyola, our ongoing project list usually runs about 150 long. That's our average. So at any given time, we have a list that size. The Executive Steering Committee only really reviews and prioritizes the A-level projects. So we have high, medium, low, and mandatory categories for projects. The only ones we ask them to really review and look at are the A projects. Occasionally, we'll call out a B or a C that isn't getting the proper attention that we think may need to be moved. So we'll highlight those for them. I guess the final thing I would add is that we do require institutional impact statements. So we used to have these long project definitions that were very technical in nature, and nobody except the people working on them really understood what the project was. So we have institutional impact statements now that are for anyone to review that really say, why do we care? Why as an institution does this project even make the list? What's the impact? What difference does it make? And so we've taken a pass at really making an effort at rewriting what the project means to Loyola, and that's been very helpful to help them ask the right questions so they know what kind of projects these are.
At Hobart and Smith, we would range in terms of an active project list between 40 to 60, depending upon where you are in either the academic year or the annual calendar. From that perspective, what I would say from an executive committee standpoint, about two-thirds of those are things that they would associate, well, that is just what IT needs to be doing to actually keep the physical plant running and keep things going. The other one-third are projects that we need them to know about. We never expect them to know technically why they're needed. They're always tied to operational imperatives. So, for example, Project A is doing something for admissions. Project B will enable a capability for HR. So it's talked more in terms about what it does operationally, and we stay away from, quite honestly, technobabble, because that's not where we want their focus to be.
Within IT at BU, we are working, we do monthly project reviews of about 50 projects. But with the service area governance committees in this latest, in this first cycle that we went through, for prospective projects, they each reviewed a list of anywhere from less than 5 to 15 or so proposed potential major projects for the coming year. The executive steering committee will look at a significant subset of that.
Project management tool. Okay, I should have intuited that. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. The project management we built in SharePoint, and it is not, it's something we built ourselves. It's mostly a communication tool. It's not something that allows us to manage a project in a manner that takes into account all the professional project management approach, you know, Slack on a project, the critical path. And we do map on a calendar, however. And we have regular communication required through the project, but that's the extent of it. That's our tool.
At Loyola, we do use Microsoft Project for the larger projects. Everything else we have is really kind of a homegrown. We have a small application internally that captures our projects, the status of the projects, who's working on them, that sort of thing. And then we have a great person on our staff who actually does all the roll-ups and the number crunching through various tools and spreadsheets and things that we've built internally.
At Hobart and at Williams Smith, we use a portfolio of things. We use SharePoint, we use Microsoft Project, and we use Excel. I would say the primary tools that are in place. What we try to not do is make it be about the tool that you are using. In fact, we were talking about this earlier. Quite honestly, I don't care if they keep the plan on the back of a napkin. The key thing is that there has to be some plan in place, and that gets rolled up and then can be consolidated into the broader portfolio that's being managed. So depending upon what level you're talking about managing the portfolio, at the project level or the program level, there's a variety of tools or techniques that could be used.
We have the same combination of a homegrown tracking tool and the other supplemental tools, but we have a project proposed for fiscal 12 for a PPM tool.
How do you deal with existing committees, some of which are anything to do with IT, and make sure that they feel that their voice in terms of input into strategy is still felt in these conversations?
I got a lot of those questions in formulating our governance structure about, well, what's going to happen to this committee and that committee and this committee that already exist. And my answer to that was that those committees can certainly continue to pursue their missions. They should have representation if appropriate and know who their representatives are on the broader governance committees, but that we didn't see the governance process as a replacement for any existing committees that are doing some form or level of IT governance. But for governance committees or committees of any type that might in some way loosely relate to this that are just pre-existing, et cetera, I would sort of think of those in the same way that you'd think of other constituencies. And the most important thing is that your governance process is visible, comprehensible, transparent, and that whatever constituency a group is coming from, they can see themselves in it. One last question? Nobody has one. Thank you very much.